Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers,
and from the law firm of Primer, Piper, Eggleston, and Kramer, providing comprehensive legal counsel to New Hampshire businesses and their owners for more than 30 years. For more information or to speak to an attorney, visit primer.com. And from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own-farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange.
Is the American economy growing for more than a decade now? Suddenly at risk of stalling, even tipping into recession.
Is this the calm before the storm, and are we in for a global recession?
The stock market posted its biggest decline of the year as a key predictor of recession is now flashing for the first time since 2007.
Today on The Exchange, it's our New Hampshire Economic News Roundup, and we'll examine what's behind these recession fears. Also, how valid are they? We'll also ask what the difference is between a recession and a slowdown, which the Congressional Budget Office predicted this week. And we'll relate these national and international trends to our own economy here in the Granite State. Of course, let's hear from you. How concerned are you about a recession? Do you think the talk is just that, talk? Or is it based on a reality that you see on the ground? What's your perception of how New Hampshire's economy is doing? Join us with a phone call at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Use Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Our guests are Russ Thibault, president of Applied Economic Research, an economic and real estate consulting firm based in Laconia. And Russ, always good to see you. Thank you for being here.
Oh, super to be here. Thanks, Laura.
Also with us, Brian Gottlob, longtime New Hampshire economist and recently appointed as the director of the state's Economic and Labor Market Information Bureau. Brian, congratulations on your new position, and thank you for being here.
Thank you, Laura. Great to be here.
Well, Brian, I'll start with you. What's your reaction to all this chatter about recession?
Well, I think there's a lot to be concerned about, Laura. There are a number of indicators that are suggesting things are slowing down. But I have to say, from my perspective, some of the concern is a little bit overblown right now.
Overblown because?
Well, I think there's discussion as if a recession is imminent. And there's really nothing that I see that suggests on the near-term horizon, at least, that we're likely to tip into a recession. And again, I've written about a number of issues that are concerning. The world economy is slowing. We've got some issues internally in this country related to business investment slowdown, a lot of uncertainty. But again, none of those suggest to me that we're likely to tip into a recession in the near term. And when I say the near term, 6 months, 9 months, maybe even a year.
I mean, recession is a big word, too. I mean, we could also just have a slowing of growth,
absolutely,
which the CBO predicted.
Absolutely. And it's pretty clear that we are slowing. We're slowing for a number of reasons. Almost all of the indicators that I look at, with one exception, well, a couple of exceptions. One, labor market's still pretty strong, although it is slowing, largely because we just don't have enough people to hire. And wages are growing. So when wages are growing and income is growth is strong and consumers are feeling pretty good, it's very hard to suggest that a recession is imminent when we know that consumers make up over three quarters or about three quarters of the U.S. economy.
Wow. Okay. So how do you see it, Russ?
Oh, well, every time I get ready for the show, Laura, I start with just random thoughts and notes and write them down. For this show, I have 11 pages of notes.
Wow.
It's just such a confusing picture. And I ended up kind of zeroing in on what I think of. And I think this is a Goldilocks economy in two respects. First, it's not too hot, not too cold. We've got pretty, very low unemployment, a 50-year low still. That's a good number. Inflation's under 2%. That's a good number. GDP is rising at 2.1%. That's a good number. So it's sort of Goldilocks, you know. But there's a wolf at the door, and it's knocking. And that wolf is coming in the form of tariffs that are mixed up. We're not sure what's happening with tariffs, interest rates, and the inverted yield curve, a world economic slowdown. And we're kind of, I think, in some respects, running out of bullets. The normal way when you get nervous about an inflation, what you do is you lower interest rates. But they're already very low. There's not a lot of steam that can come out of dropping rates from, say, 2.5% to 2%. That's not a big shift. And then if you look at taxes, we've just had the biggest tax cut 2 years ago on record. So we don't have a lot of tools. If we are heading to a recession, we don't have a lot of tools to push back. We don't have many bullets to hit that wolf with.
Well, I want to definitely talk to both of you about the tools, because there has been a lot of conversation about this, as you said, interest rates and tax cuts and other sort of levers that policymakers use to bolster the economy. But just to give both of you a little sympathy about how hard it is to really predict what's going on, our producer, Christina Phillips, pulled some clips of several economists trying to figure this out on TV just over the past week. Let's hear.
We're not going into recession.
We think that there's a good chance that the U.S. economy goes into a recession in the middle of next year.
I think it's more likely that we'll have incremental deterioration. Things were going very well. Now they're going to go a little worse. I don't think it's worse than that.
I would argue that the next global downturn is already upon us.
We certainly don't see a recession, but we see it very difficult to invest in assets kind of at all-time highs.
Most economists and business people are pretty good at telling you why the recession occurred after it occurred, but not when it's going to occur.
Okay, yikes. So why is this so hard to figure out, Brian?
It couldn't be clearer from those clips what's happening. I mean, if you can't discern, Laura, what's going to happen over the next year from that series of clips, I don't know, you know, you're just not getting the picture, the clear picture that it's presenting. I think it's difficult because, one, we focus on an awful lot of indicators. And anytime you look at anybody who looks at a lot of economic indicators, no matter whether the economy is strong or whether the economy is weak, you're going to see conflicting numbers. You know, the real challenge, I think, in the economics profession is to take all of those numbers that some say are up and some say are down and to try to make some sense out of it for policymakers, for decision makers. And it is a very difficult thing to do because we all have one or two indicators that we think are the most important. And if you focus on one or two, then it's easier to draw those conclusions. When you look at the full realm of all of the different economic data that is out there, it becomes a much more muddled picture. Economists are noted, it's probably the one issue that perplexes economists more than any other, accurately predicting a recession. There is nobody that's very good at it. Those who have been good at it make their name on it. If you think back to the Great Recession, there was a couple of economists that kind of called the Great Recession, and they made their reputation and their name because there was one or two who were accurately able to do that. Out of the entire profession, by the way.
Of course, they might have just been lucky.
Lucky,
but,
yeah.
in a sort of odd way.
It's been said he predicted 9 of the last 3 recessions,
yeah,
you know?
So, yeah, exactly, right.
I go by what I call the soda shop index. The soda shop is a kind of cafe in Laconia, and if I go in there and eat my sandwich and nobody asks me about the economy, I know things are fine. I go in there now, and it's like I get pestered. I can hardly get a mouthful without somebody asking. You know, so people are nervous. People are nervous in this economy. And, you know, on the one hand, you've got, for example, you have Trump saying the economy's fine, but we got to fix it fast. Yesterday, the Fed's notes of their July meeting were released. About half
the Federal Reserve.
Half of the members on the rate setting committee said we should lower rates
Even
to stimulate.
More.
This is the Fed. Now, they have the biggest army of economists in the world. Half of them said we need to lower rates. Half of them said we need to keep them the same. And the other half, the third half, said, no, we need to raise them. So it is a confusing picture right now. And your clips highlighted that beautifully.
Well, here's a question for you then, Russ. You know, your soda shop, is that the name of it? The soda shop analogy. Is all this chatter of recession creating a narrative that makes people that you meet at the soda shop nervous, even if the economic fundamentals themselves are pretty solid?
No, I don't think
so. Can you
so.
Talk
I think,
down
I think
the economy,
their concern
so
is real. It's legitimate. When you have, for example, well, we're going to impose a lot of tariffs on Mexico on Thursday, and then on Friday that we're not going to do any. we're going to impose a very broad tariffs on a very broad spectrum of Chinese imports. And then, no, we're going to wait till after Christmas. So there's just a lot of up and down. You know, at the top of this economy, the president and the Fed, the two biggest entities out there that have the largest influence over our economy, are confused.
Well, here there have been mixed messages from the White House, and businesses this week were saying, just tell us what it is and we'll work with it. Let's hear a little bit from President Trump talking about tax cuts, indexing for inflation and interest rates. This is 2 days ago, this audio courtesy of Politico.
I'm not talking about doing anything at this moment, but indexing is something that a lot of people have liked for a long time, and it's something that would be very easy to do. And a lot of people have been talking about indexing for many years, and it's something that I am certainly thinking about. I can say that a majority of the people in the White House at the level that does this kind of thing, they like indexing. So it is something I'm thinking about. Payroll taxes, I've been thinking about payroll taxes for a long time, whether or not we do it now or not is it's not being done because of recession, because we are legitimately, if we had a cut in interest rates by the Fed, if they would do their job properly and if they would do a meaningful cut because they raised too fast, you would see growth like you've not seen ever in this country.
Okay, again, that's the president speaking 2 days ago. I want to talk about interest rates in a minute, but first of all, Brian, just indexing, what is that?
Well, I think what the president is talking about there is the indexing of the tax tables for the personal income tax. One of the effects that occurs when prices rise and inflation occurs is that you earn more money, but you may not actually be wealthier. And if the tax tables aren't indexed and, you know, if they don't reflect the fact that you're not actually better off or earning, you may be earning more, but you're not wealthier as a result of higher prices, then you wind up paying more effectively in taxes. So indexing is, in a way, a tax cut because...
Yeah, people appreciate the fact that it's the tax code is reflecting the higher costs that
they're paying. It's reflecting higher costs and more reflective of the an individual or a household's wealth. So it does get talked about every once in a while. I don't know that it's been done when the last time it was done, but it is done periodically. We're not using the 1940s tax tables in order to to figure out our liabilities. It would be an easy way to offer a relatively minor cut in what is taken out of households' pockets.
Okay, so there's the president 2 days ago talking about we like indexing, thinking up about payroll taxes. And then here he is yesterday talking again about interest rates and indexing. This audio is from the Wall Street Journal, and you'll hear the president seem to reverse positions from earlier in the week.
I'm not looking to do indexing. I've studied indexing for a long time. I think it will be perceived if I do it as somewhat elitist. I don't want to do that. I want taxes for the middle class, the workers, the people that work so hard. That's what I'm looking. I think indexing is really probably better for the upper income groups. I'm not looking to do that. But if I wanted to do it, I believe I could, but I'd need a letter from the Attorney General. I'm not looking at a tax cut now. We don't need it. We have a strong economy. Certainly a payroll tax cut. President Obama did that in order to artificially jack up the economy. President Obama had zero interest rates. I don't have zero interest. I have real interest rates. And despite that, I have a strong economy.
Okay, so there's some policy reversals, if we could call it that, Russ. And how do business people react to all these different mixed messages from the White
House? They react unfavorably. What we're seeing is capital expenditures for new plants, for new equipment down sharply. And think back to the president's tax cut. The corporate tax rate dropped from, 35% to 20%, a huge tax cut for corporate America, with the thought that with lower taxes, they're going to invest in America. They're going to build new plants. They're going to hire more people. They're going to raise wages. And that tax cut was when the economy was doing very well. Normally, you don't do a tax cut in that environment. So what do we get instead? We're getting like 1% growth in capital expenditures, which is down sharply. So,
although shortly after the tax cut, we did see a boost from consumer spending.
There was a very temporary boost, and a lot of it was stock buybacks and bonuses for corporate executives. It didn't filter down. It didn't trickle down the way that it was thought it would do. It didn't achieve the main thing it was designed to do, which is to increase business private sector investment, and that's not been happening. So, getting ready for the show, I thought, you know, maybe this boom that we've had, this 9-year boom, is kind of fake. Maybe it was artificially stimulated by these huge deficits, which, by the way, this year looks like it's going to be a $1 trillion deficit. And maybe it was artificially stimulated by extremely low interest rates. Before the downturn began, the Fed fund rate was 5.25%. It was dropped to effectively zero. So borrowing money was almost free. Go for it. Then we have this huge tax cut, thinking that will really stimulate the economy. And here we are with GDP growth, okay, but slowing down. Unemployment rate is very, as I said, you know, a lot of the indicators right now, snapshot, look very good, but the wolf is at the door and we don't have many bullets to get rid of them.
Although that's what policymakers do, right, guys? Brian, I'll turn to you first. You know, they I don't want to say play with monetary
right.
policy, but they set interest rates at the Federal Reserve. They do taxes and spending and so forth. So that's partly their job. So are you saying, Russ, real quick, and then I want to go to Brian, too. Are you saying that the fundamentals haven't been good for a long time, but they've been sort of painted over with a pretty color by these policy tools?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I'm saying that the fundamentals haven't been as they've been artificially stimulated. We've had a shot of adrenaline in the economy at a time when it probably would have done okay. So here we are now, with a world economy that is softening, and in the United States, we already have very low interest rates. We already have a huge deficit. What are we going to do if, in fact, and Brian's right, it's not clear there's going to be a recession, but if, in fact, we do move into a recession, we don't have many tools. It's kind of like the infection that is resistant to every antibiotic. If something goes wrong, if we do move into a recession in the United States now, there's not much room to lower interest rates.
I see what you're saying.
And there's not much room to stimulate with more and more and more spending without really tripping into. Already, we're at the highest rate of debt to GDP since World War II.
I see what you're saying. So, sure, go ahead and use the policy tools, low interest rates, deficit spending, tax cuts, whatever. But you're saying those have been used, so now there's not a lot of, you know, options left on the table. Go ahead, Brian. Let your thoughts there.
I think, you know, one of the problems is that we don't really have a coherent economic policy. We have a lot of ad hoc individual policies, and some of them work against one another. So we have interest rate is one of the policies, but then we have tariffs that, you know, interest rates are supposed to spark business investment. But then you have a tariff policy that makes individual businesses reluctant to invest because they don't know what the situation is going to be, what the markets are going to look like, what their cost structure is going to be like. So that operates in opposition to one another. There is no coherency to the policy.
So the uncertainty, the flip-flops are disturbing to business.
And they counteract one another. One policy is designed to have this effect, stimulating investment. But the other policy, maybe not directly or, you know, it's not the stated purpose of it, which the whole tariff policy, which has the function of reducing investment. The other problem that I see, and this I think is we have just come to rely on monetary policy way, way too much for growth. We're looking at monetary policy instead of the things that actually matter in driving growth. Labor force and productivity growth are the keys to long-term economic growth, and we are not directing policies at those.
Very interesting, and we will pick up on that after a short break, especially since a lot of people are talking about that Federal Reserve meeting in Jackson Hole, Wyoming over the weekend. Lots of anticipation about what Fed Chairman Jerome Powell will say. We'll start taking your calls, too. We'd love your perception of some of the talk about recession recently. And as we've heard from our guests, it's complicated. But we'd like your thoughts at 1-800-892-6477. Give us your perception of how New Hampshire's economy is doing. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, and we'll hear from you right after a short break.
Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Edvest and You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, it's our New Hampshire Economic News Roundup. And as we look at national and international trends and how they're being viewed and felt in the Granite State, we'd love to hear from you. How concerned are you about some of the talk about recession these days? Is it just media chatter? Is it based on what you see in your community? Give us your perception of how you think New Hampshire's economy is doing. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Our economists are Russ Thibault and Brian Gottlob. And gentlemen, let's go right to our listeners. And Jerry's calling from Dover. Hi, Jerry. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Laura. I have two comments. The first one, I haven't heard very much about it in any of the media. In the past, when the economy was good, although we didn't reduce the total amount in dollars of our deficit, at least it was reduced as a percentage of GDP. And in this administration, even though the economy is doing relatively well, we're increasing the deficit and the percentage of the GDP. The GDP is also going up. We need to address this issue because when things turn around, the deficit is just going to balloon incredibly. The second comment that I have, this president seems to have zero understanding of very basic economic principles. And it seems like everything is a knee-jerk reaction. For example, his comments within 2 days of indexing, it's just beyond. And I'll take the replies to my comments off the air. Thank you very much.
Well, Jerry, thank you very much. And I'm really glad you called because the Congressional Budget Office said just yesterday, I think, that federal deficits are expected to swell to higher levels over the next decade than previously expected. The U.S. budget deficit is expected to hit $960 billion this year and average after that $1.2 trillion per year over the next decade. Now, I've been looking at economic trends for a long time. And Brian, I remember when the debt was the trillion number, not the deficit. That's right. Supposed to be the smaller number because deficits accumulate right. to add up to debt. Right. So I'm really glad Jerry called, and I would love both of your thoughts, starting with you, Brian, on these new deficit projections from the CBO.
Yeah. One thing I want to mention about the caller, he's absolutely right in one respect, and that's we broke from probably 50 years or more of economic policy, fiscal policy in this country. Typically, fiscal policy is countercyclical. When the economy is very strong, we take in a little bit more in terms of revenues and we fill our coffers. And when the economy is weak, we spend that down and we run higher deficits.
We push the gas
right.
pedal, so to
speak.
So we
reverse that. And we have a pro-cyclical. We had a relatively strong economy and we decided to add that stimulus. So he's right about that. That is very unusual. The issue of the debt is critical. And I'm not sure everybody understands why. It's important for a number of reasons. One is the whole generational equity issue, leaving debt to future generations. The second is that it has macroeconomic effects. When we run deficits, we reduce our savings rates, which has an impact on investment. And ultimately long-term productivity. And it has an impact on the size of the government. Basically, what we're doing is we're allowing us ourselves to feel wealthier because we're borrowing. We're borrowing and spending more. So we feel wealthier today when, in fact, at some later point, we will feel less wealthy, or a future generation will feel less wealthy. So, you know, those are three really important impacts of the deficit, and any one of them is enough to be concerned about the deficit, but when you or the debt, and when you add them all together, it becomes really troubling. But I think most people focus on one or the other, but all three of them really have a substantial impact.
Go ahead, Russ.
I think we've done a lousy job of helping the average American understand the implications of the deficit, which has gone from 30% of GDP in 2010 to 80% today, and is projected to go to over 100% the way we're going now.
That's the deficit or the debt?
That's the debt. Excuse me, the debt. Thank you. I think that the thing that caught my eye, one thing that really caught my eye as far as the implication of this, is going forward, interest on that debt is going to become the largest part of the federal budget. It's going to squeeze out defense spending. It's going to squeeze out the social safety net. We're going to have to pay that back. And it's going to come in the form of either higher taxes or reduced spending for things like defense and social welfare programs. We've just done a lousy job because the debt is sort of this nebulous thing. You know, you're driving your car. You don't feel that, you know?
That's interesting.
So you can get away with it as an elected official. You can have your cake and eat it too. You spend a lot of money and not raise in fact, lower taxes. But it's a myth.
So you have to pay the interest back on that loan, so to speak. And that means you can't spend money on other stuff that you might care about.
Yes, it's going to be, you know, we're going to have to cut education spending in order to pay this interest for this, as I called it, fake boom that we've had over the last, somewhat fake.
But no politician, Brian, likes to say no to tax cuts or no to spending on cool programs. I mean, this is a Republican and Democratic problem. Deficits are, you know, a bipartisan problem.
Exactly. It's a point that I made a bit earlier. It's that it allows us to feel wealthier, like we have more to spend, when in fact we don't really have more to spend. So we feel wealthier today at the expense of tomorrow. But I will say there is, and this is particularly troubling, I think, there is kind of a movement out there or a belief that as long as our income or our GDP is growing faster than the interest on our debt, the interest rate on our debt, that we can continue to sustain this. And that's kind of a new thinking. It's old thinking, but being repackaged as new. So the debt really isn't troubling because our GDP growth and our income growth is going to be higher than our interest rate on our debt, and therefore we'll have no trouble servicing it. I think that's very wrong, but it is one of those discussions that you hear among policymakers in Washington. From my perspective, pretty troubling.
All right. Well, Jerry, thank you very much for raising that, because that is definitely in the news this week. You can join us to 1-800-892-6477. It's our New Hampshire Economic News Roundup today in the Exchange. We've been looking at why there's been some talk of recession recently, what that talk is based on, how our guests view it, and we've been looking at the New Hampshire impact of some of these economic trends, whether it's trade or interest rates or the deficit. Join us again with your comments and questions, your perception of how you view the economy right here in the Granite State. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. You can use Facebook or Twitter as well. It's NHPR Exchange. And both of you, Mark in Epping wrote us. He says, a colleague recently went to the Newington Mall and counted 11 empty stores. Driving past a small strip mall in my own town this week, I noticed 2 out of the 6 spaces were empty. Is this an indicator of economic troubles? Mark, I was reading the Berlin Daily Sun this morning, and just because I like to look at local headlines, and a Citizens Bank is closing down in Berlin, and a small grocery store is closing down in Berlin. So, Mark, thank you for the note. And Russ, what do you think? Is this a sign of overall economic trouble, or is this part of the sort of disruption in the retail sector that we're seeing?
I think it's a disruption in the retail sector. Retail spending actually has been kind of strong lately. But I think it's, first of all, a shift, of course, to online spending, which has grown a lot faster than brick and mortar spending in brick and mortar stores, as they're called. But by the same token, if you look at Home Depot this week, announced that their growth rate is going to drop from over 3% to a little over 2%. So a lot of retailers are saying, hey, this tariff thing is going to hit us, JCPenney. So prices are going up, and when retailers try to pass the prices of the tariffs on to consumers, consumers saying, no way, Jose. There was a quote, if I may, or an analysis done by researchers at J.P. Morgan, that the $250 billion worth of Chinese imports amount to a tax of about $600 annually on an average American household. So that's sucking money out of the retail sector. Right now, retail is doing well, but he brings up a good point, which is this sustainable? And it may well not be in the face of tariffs that are about to expand if Trump holds to his saying, particularly after Christmas, on essentially everything that we import.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I saw that exact same analysis from J.P. Morgan, that the tariffs imposed on China have already meant a tax of $600 annually on the average American household. Again, that's from J.P. Morgan, which also says when the next wave of tariffs is fully in place in December, these researchers said anyway, the cost will rise to $1,000 per household. Can you just remind us how that works, Brian, how a tariff means an extra $600 on your average American household? Because that sounds like a lot of money. And then I have another question for you on that. But go ahead. Just remind us how that works, how a tariff makes things more expensive for me.
Well, a tariff is basically it's a tax that's paid on a material, a commodity, or a finished product that is imported into our country. And it's paid by who's ever doing the importing. So if Walmart is importing, as they do, a number of goods from China, then they pay that import. They pay that import tax.
And they're not going to eat it. They're going to pass it on to consumers.
No, I mean, in general, they may try to eat it. It's up to individual companies how much of that they can do it. And, I think at 10% tariff, some companies probably ate some of it. When you're talking about 25% tariffs, then it becomes much harder to do that. And the tariffs have progressively impacted consumers more and more. It started out primarily on goods that were imported by manufacturers or by companies that used whatever was being imported in the production of their goods and services.
So it's kind of internal. It was hidden
a little bit. I mean, you did feel it to some degree. So steel is there's a tariff on steel. So your washing machine becomes a little bit more costly. Now what we're seeing, these next rounds are beginning to affect things like electronics. That's, Apple iPhones and computers, et cetera. And they're going to continue so that they'll start affecting things like clothing, more consumer goods that are directly going to be reflected in the prices on the shelf at retail stores.
But isn't the argument then, okay, Apple, make your stuff in the USA. Okay, apparel makers, produce it in the USA, and then you won't have to deal with tariffs, and then you won't need to pass on those costs to consumers. That's the fundamental argument there.
That will be reflected in prices as well. I mean, a big reason why the manufacturing is occurring in those countries is that prices, cost of producing them in other countries is lower. And there's no guarantee that those tariffs, and that's in fact what's happening, tariffs on China, it doesn't mean that those companies that are producing in China are going to produce in the U.S. What are they doing? They're going to other low-cost countries, Vietnam or Indonesia or some other countries in Asia.
Yeah, I had read that a couple of factories that you might have expected to come back, or that policymakers had hoped would come back to the U.S. decided to go to Vietnam instead. Real quick, Russ.
Yeah, real quick. It's not that easy. There's a chain of supply that has built up in China that you can't, in the short term, reproduce here. You can't all of a sudden decide we're going to make iPhones in New Hampshire. All of the suppliers, the little parts here, the little parts there, the little button, the screen, all of that.
The contracts to, we'll let you do this for the next 3 years. You can't just break that.
Well, that may be it. But it's just impossible to shift it in the short term. Maybe over a 10-year period you can do that.
All right. lots of listeners who want to jump in with their views on how the economy is doing. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. And Russ and Brian, let's go to Nancy in Wolfboro. Hi, Nancy. You're on the air. Thanks for calling in today.
Hi. Thank you. So you asked about how the economy has been in our communities, and I just wanted to say that my daughter's two best friends has two parents who both work, and over the past year, both families have been homeless at some point.
Wow.
So I think this conversation is sort of missing the point about how this is affecting regular Americans and that they're struggling, and we're hearing that in through all the candidates and so forth. So I'd love for you to speak to that issue.
Well, sure. And do you know a little bit about why your daughter's friends are homeless, despite the fact that both are working?
Sure. They're both working very low-wage. They're all working low-wage jobs, and the rents are just soaring.
This is something, Nancy, thank you so much. And this is something we've talked a lot about on other shows on The Exchange. Russ, I just want to give you an opportunity to remind people that even if you're working in New Hampshire, rent is very high. Housing costs are very high.
Yeah, rents are phenomenally high, and the vacancy rate is under 1%. So it's almost, if you're lucky enough to find a place, you're going to have to pay a lot of money for it. And I think that she raises the very big question, the elephant in the room, which is another aspect of this boom, is that it's been disproportionately skewed to the upper income categories, the upper wealth categories. Stock market's up, what, 300%? Wages are up 3% a year, you know. So it's not been an equitable boom. The longest boom on record now has not been equitable. It's not benefited everybody across the board.
Well, thank you very much, Nancy, and good luck to your daughter's friends. And Christopher in Hudson wrote us with an alternative view. He says there seems to be a lot of growth around Manchester after years of new construction stagnation. Christopher says two new hotels are under construction downtown. Former Sears by the Mall of New Hampshire is being repurposed as a Dick's Sporting Goods. The tractors are rolling on Goff Mill Plaza in Bedford again, and the signs are up for the new BAE Systems location at the location of the former Blue Cross Blue Shield. That's right. I remember talking about that BAE expansion on another economic roundup. Christopher says, I guess it's still about location, location, location. Christopher, thank you so much because, Brian, you know, in my little world here in Concord, I see lots of economic activity.
Right. I New Hampshire's in a good place overall when you look at the aggregate numbers. Job growth is strong. There's a good amount of construction activity, but it is rather localized. I mean, it's concentrated mostly on the seacoast and in the Manchester and to a degree down south toward Nashua areas. So those areas are absorbing a disproportionate amount of both individuals who are moving to New Hampshire, which has been picking up, but also investment in business investment. So BA Systems choosing Manchester. We see what's happening in the Mill Yard in Manchester is very positive. Pease Air Force Base has been terrific. My community, Dover, has seen just an extraordinary boom in building. So while you look at the aggregate numbers, it is looking very positive, but it is rather localized. I mean, I talk
some
a lot
of that local activity though has to spread out, Brian. That we, all the activity in Concord and Dover and Portsmouth and Manchester and Nashua and Hanover and other places.
It does spread, so it's not just in the communities, but regionally there is an impact. I look a lot at demographics, and one of the most troubling things that I've seen in a while is that over the most recent decade, 6 of the 10 counties in New Hampshire have had more people die than born. So that means if they aren't attracting individuals into those regions, if they're not seeing in-migration, then their population is going to decline and ultimately their economy will decline. And there are some communities that have been able to do that, some counties that have been able to do that. Belknap County has seen enough in-migration to keep from population loss, but not all of them. So, again, it does point to a kind of a regionalization or localization of the strength of the New Hampshire economy.
Very interesting. And, Chris, thank you very much for that email. We'll take more of your calls and emails after a short break. We want to hear your perceptions of the New Hampshire economy, your thoughts when you hear news headlines and economists talking about the possibility of recession, others saying no way, others saying not right now. We'd love your thoughts. 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on our show, the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup, your chance to catch up on all the state news you might have missed this week. That's Friday morning, live at 9. This hour, it's our New Hampshire Economic News Roundup, and we've been looking at interest rates, what the Federal Reserve might do, also debt, deficits, job growth, and all the talk of recession recently. Join us with your thoughts, questions, comments, observations, 1-800-892-6477. What is your view of how the economy is doing these days? Again, our number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And Russ Tebow, Brian Gottlob, let's go right back to our listeners. Charlie's calling from Laconia, your hometown, Russ. Charlie, good morning. Go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning. Good morning. I just wanted to comment on the remarks about the companies looking, you know, that moved overseas for lower labor cost, and then they were maybe going to looking from China to other companies or countries. I recall when these companies started moving out of the country, I don't recall our prices dropping because they said, oh, look, we're saving all this money and it's costing us less money to make products, so we're saving, we're passing that savings on to you. You know, to me, the only people that have benefited this from, and it's not a bad thing, I guess, are the company owners or the stockholders or somebody, but certainly not the consumer. And, you know, when they talk about the cost of steel because of the tariffs and stuff, well, then get your, you touched on this earlier, get your steel right here in the United States. There are plenty of mills making steel around here, and you know, I just the whole thing is just smoke and mirrors to me. That's how I've always looked at it.
Yeah, Charlie, I'm really glad you called, and you're making me think we need to do just a whole refresh show on tariffs and trade and how it all works. But this is a great point, Russ. That if companies move their factories overseas to save money, Charlie's saying, I haven't seen those savings. It kind of reminds me when the cost of jet fuel or just gasoline in general goes down, airline tickets don't really seem to drop. So I'd love your thoughts on Charlie's point.
Well, I think that, you know, you look at the iPhone, which is made in China, then the new ones, I think, are over $1,000 for a telephone. You know, it's like, whoa, wait a minute. I thought this was supposed to be
more than a telephone, but still, yeah, I get your point.
Yeah, a little more than a phone. The point, though, I think, is that one of the problems with economics is you don't have a control thing like give a placebo to these people and real pills to those people. We don't know how much a shirt would cost if it were made in America instead of China or Bangladesh.
That's
in other words, I think I pay about the same amount for a shirt today as I did when I was in high school, which was in the 60s. So I think that it's true, Charlie, that to a great degree we haven't realized all of the savings. But it's a little hard to measure it because we're not sure how much that shirt would cost if it was made in. I recall my wife wanted to buy boots made in America, and she ended up buying a pair of boots made in America. They weren't L.L. Bean, although those are made in America. And they were expensive, and they were ugly, you know. So I think that to some degree the savings are sort of hidden by the fact that things would be a lot more expensive had they always been made in America. But he's
but
got
we
a point.
Don't know, and that's why I really appreciate the point. Yeah, Brian, companies are saying, we're moving overseas to save money. Yeah. So Charlie's saying, okay, where's the savings?
Yeah, but one of the things that we also Russ's point about the counterfactual, not being able to measure the counterfactual is absolutely appropriate.
You can't have one iPhone factory in Michigan and one iPhone factory in China and then compare the two.
But the other thing is that you have to think, you have to factor in what product improvements are and how that might be reflected in price increases. Were the iPhone not manufactured in China? How much more can today's iPhone do than an iPhone 15 years ago or 10 years ago? Prices certainly have risen. I guess the question is what would prices be if those were manufactured here in the U.S. with the same level of product improvement, the same level of innovation, the same quality? And that's, again, a counterfactual. But sometimes prices rise, but the quality, you know, the characteristics of the product change pretty dramatically. And so you're actually getting a whole lot more. Think of TVs. You know, TV prices have actually come down. But not only have they come down in a lot of ways, but think of what you can do with them now.
If you can figure it out. But that's another show.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Right on.
So, you know, so there It's a much more complicated. Yeah, prices don't generally decline, and sometimes they stay about the same or they rise a little bit, but the innovation and the quality of the product and what it can do rises much more dramatically. So,
well, Charlie, I really appreciate the point. And Russ, go ahead, and then we'll go back to our listeners.
I just was going to say, in defense of Charlie and Brian and myself, some of the savings have accrued to corporate America and their balance sheet.
Well, I think
and
that's
some have accrued
saying.
To consumers.
Yeah. And that's Brian's point. TVs have gotten cheaper.
Yeah. So it's a little hard to split the relative improvement in things between the corporate savings and the consumer savings.
And you're saying also,
some of both.
You seem to make the point earlier, Russ, that clothing costs are still relatively low in this country.
Yeah. Yeah, they are.
All right. Well, yeah. We'll have to take another look at trade because it's interesting. And let's go next to Manchester, where Matthew's on the line. Hi, Matthew, you're on the air. Welcome. Thanks for calling in.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I have a question. We were hearing about tariffs and the cost of tariffs. Can your guests recommend any lifestyle changes, strategies, or techniques that the consumer can take to avoid paying tariffs?
Wow. Matthew, what a great question. And I thought of that, Brian, when you were talking about, you know, steel tariffs, for example, raising the cost of washing machines. And I was thinking, ooh, I kind of need a new fridge, but maybe I'll hold on to my clunker for now. I love your question, Matthew. Can you guys answer that? How do you avoid paying tariffs?
Well, increasingly it's going to be impossible because more goods are going to have a tariff placed on them. I think one of the immediate responses that is offered is that, well, just buy a product that's made in the U.S. and you'll avoid the tariffs. But you know what? When the tariffs on washing machines that were made overseas were put in place, what happened? Well, the price of imported washing machines went up. But you know what? The price of domestically made washing machines also went up. So that gets at the whole corporate issue.
Because the domestic washing machine makers said, hey, the foreign ones
extract,
are up.
They may not have gone up as much, but they still went up. They were able to extract a rent from consumers just simply from the fact that a tariff was placed on an imported machine that made the prices go up faster there. So they were still able to raise their prices, just not maybe as much, or in some cases they did raise as much. But that complicates the whole issue because I do think a lot of people think if you just buy something that is not subject to a tariff, you will necessarily be able to avoid that cost, but that's not necessarily the case. And, you know, that's a corporate America kind of issue. It gets at one of the previous callers' issues.
Sure. So if the competition from Korea or Japan raises its prices are raised because of the tariff, then the Made in America group says, why not?
And it happened,
I'll keep mine like $5 lower.
It happened with steel. Same thing with steel. Steel prices went up. Domestically made steel prices went up when there was import tariffs placed on it.
All right, Matthew, thank you for the call. Russ?
I was just going to say, too, that something, I don't know if we touched on it fully. I agree with Brian that, one of the things that we really haven't talked about that much is that the tariff situation, apart from the actual situation as it exists now and may exist in December or whatever, it is sort of a deer in the headlights impact on corporate America. They're saying, I don't know, maybe I'll build that new steel plant in Pennsylvania. But then again, he may stop those tariffs and I'll be competing again with cheap Chinese imports or Vietnamese imports. So there's sort of a freeze effect on capital spending when you have erratic tariff policy or a dramatic change in tariff policy as we're experiencing now. So it gets harder to maybe justify building a plant in America, ironically, because you're just not sure as the CEO, okay, this is going to cost me $1 billion. Should I really do this? Maybe not.
Wow.
Maybe I'll wait
so
and see.
So policy uncertainty is harmful to that long-term business decision-making. You don't want to spend all that money if you don't know what's going to
happen. Predictable environment if you're going to be shelling out $1 billion here and $1 billion
there.
Sure.
That's absolutely a terrific point. One of the weaknesses of our current economy is business investment. The tariff issue is playing right into that, and it's exacerbating the slowdown in business investment for the reasons that Russ mentioned. So, it's counteracting what are the supposed benefits of the tariff policy. It's actually reducing investment rather than encouraging investment in the country.
Let's take another call. This is Jan calling in. Hi, Jan. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, thank you. Sure. I pulled over to this side of the road. This is such an important subject. I don't feel like an item made in a foreign country and an item made in America, you can't compare the two. It's not a zero-sum game. The profits that come from a foreign-made item, the money from those go to the corporation, as has been covered here. But an American worker, even a union American worker who makes a better wage, that money goes right back into our economy. They don't buy a Learjet. They don't buy a home in the south of France. They go out and they buy a second car or braces for their kid, or they can get a job because they can afford daycare. It drives our whole economy, and it's the middle class and the worker that is always shortchanged. So we buy local. We buy American-made when we can. If I have to pay a little bit more for it, I do, because I know that money's going to go right back into the economy. I've owned 5 of my own companies, and I spent the last 10 years working for a major airline and could not have done it without my union.
Well, Jan, go ahead.
It's important to have our workers make money in America. I worked in the 70s, and I made as much in the 70s as a young person in the city of Chicago as I did when I started for an airline. The wages have not kept pace. We need to pay our workers at least $15 an hour.
Jan,
we need to get the money back into the middle class.
Well, this is a really important point, and we've been talking about, you know, the impact of tariffs on corporate America's bottom line, also on the consumers. But she's absolutely right, and I'm glad you pulled over, Jan. Russ, what do you think? You know, even if you pay $3 more for that shirt made by an American, that American is spending that money in his or her community.
Absolutely right. And it's right across the board, whether you're buying a manufactured good or whether you're buying a book in downtown Concord versus on Amazon. And I got to say, I'm guilty of going to Amazon because of the convenience. But there's no question that the whole buy local, whether you define local as America or whether you define it as Main Street Concord, there is a much bigger economic impact in spending that same dollar one way versus another way. And she's right.
Thank you so much for calling in, Jan. And gentlemen, I read an email earlier, I think it was from Chris, who said, hey, things look pretty good in Manchester. And we talked about, you know, definitely some of the growth spots here in New Hampshire. New Hampshire's unemployment rate is still incredibly low, although I'm guessing you guys would say that's partly a demographic issue because it's just not enough people to fill those jobs. But here's another perspective from Ben in Hudson. He says it's actually very obvious that the U.S. economy is faltering and edging toward a depression rather than a recession, Ben says. Anyone familiar with the 2008 crisis understands that the underlying instabilities were not dealt with. Rather, the bubble was blown up further by the Fed to prevent its eventual burst. Ben says through corporate stock buybacks, Wall Street's overvalued stocks were made so expensive that no one wants to buy them, and then the only direction for them to go is down. The money for buybacks, he says, takes away from new jobs and wage increases to pad the pockets of investors. Ben says the real economy and the financial economy became disconnected years ago, and this must change if we're ever going to achieve sustainable growth. Ben, thank you so much. Kind of reminds me, Brian, of what you said earlier in this show that you know, we've been using financial tools
right
to prop up the economy. But you said, you know, growth is really about people working, people showing up, people innovating stuff, people being productive.
Right. He makes a good point. A concern about the disconnect between financial markets and asset values and the real underlying strength of the economy. When that gets out of whack, it is, you know, that is a time when you should be worrying about a recession. You know, just think back to our most recent recession. What happened? Well, it was the housing market and asset values in housing that got out of whack, that overvalued, kind of disconnected between you know, their true value and what was happening in the underlying economy, and eventually that burst. You know, there's some concern about that with the stock market as potentially, you know, an asset imbalance. And by the way, low interest rates drive up asset values higher, so that contributes to it.
Low interest rates makes stocks more
attractive.
Exactly.
All assets more valuable. I don't see as many of those concerns as some people. The one area that I have maybe a little bit more concern about is there's a lot of corporate debt out there. You know, it's very high. It's at its highest level. And some people say, well, you know, GDP growth is strong enough that that's not a problem. But when you look at the distribution of that debt, much more of it is going to lower grade debt and companies that are kind of a little bit more shaky. And so if interest rates rise, the economy turns down, I kind of wonder if we don't have some zombie companies that aren't going to make it when things do turn down. So that's the one area that I'm more concerned about. I don't see a lot of excess in the economy, in the financial world. I mean, yeah, stocks are probably a little overvalued, but I'm more concerned with what's happening in the corporate debt.
Zombie area. Companies. That's what keeps economists up at night.
Yeah, I mean, there's companies that are living off of leverage. They're living off the leverage, and they can do that because interest rates are so low.
What are you going to be looking at in the next couple of weeks, Russ, in terms of economic indicators, reports? Obviously, the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas is holding this big meeting in Jacksonville, Wyoming, which is a really pretty place, by the way. Good place for a meeting.
I just think watching, there's so many things to keep an eye on right now. It's hard to say. One thought I had was that last year we had a very good economy and the Red Sox won the World Series.
Okay.
This year, the Red Sox are faltering a bit, and look where we are with the economy. So maybe what we should be watching is, are the Red Sox going to do well in the balance of the year? Little that's left. I think interest rates, the stock market is probably volatile. That will be a nice thing to keep an eye on. Is it going to be up 800 points one day and down 800 points the next day, or down 1,000?
So some change obviously is normal, but these big mega swings are concerning.
They are. And the stock market is not the economy, but it is a reflection of investor confidence. So maybe if one thing I would keep an eye on most would probably be the market.
All right. Well, whetting our appetites for the next time. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much, gentlemen, for being here.
I want to congratulate Brian on his new gig.
Yes.
At Labor Market Information Bureau. It's my favorite state agency. Congratulations.
Thank you, Russ.
And that is Brian Gottlob, again, longtime New Hampshire economist, and as Russ said, recently appointed the director of the state's Economic and Labor Market Information Bureau. Russ Thibault is also with us, president of Applied Economic Research based in Laconia. And you're listening to The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.